It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at a surprising new beauty trend, young women turning their hair gray.
First, a new Wall Street Journal opinion piece alleges that Kevin Kennedy, director of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board, was part of a coordinated effort to target and harass conservative groups here in the state.
According to the Wall Street Journal piece, Kennedy was friendly with former IRS official Lois Lerner, who headed the IRS tax-exempt division, accused of targeting conservative groups seeking nonprofit status.
Republican state lawmakers today called for Kennedy to step down, citing a potential coordinated effort between Kennedy's Government Accountability Board and the Obama administration to investigate conservative groups. One of the lawmakers calling for Kennedy's resignation is Representative John Nygren. He's co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, and he joins us now. Representative Nygren, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
So make the basic case for us, please. Why should Kevin Kennedy step down from the Government Accountability Board?
Well, I mean, I think there's long been questions, especially from conservatives, about the government accountability's ability to do manage elections in Wisconsin in a fair and balanced way. There was an audit back in back this early spring that showed that statutorily there were several failures over multiple years as far as them being able to conduct the their responsibilities appropriately. And at the time, you know, I kept, like some others at that point in time, some were calling for him to step down at that point in time, but that time I kept my powder dry. But now with further allegations, and I agree that there are allegations at this point in time, but this is not necessarily about guilt. This is about the public's ability to be able to have a level of trust that their elections are being managed in a fair, balanced, and most importantly, a nonpartisan way. And with these allegations, with the statutory failures in the past, I do think it's time for the Government Accountability Board to look for some new leadership.
And in a joint press release from you and Senator Alberta Darling, you call the Government Accountability Board a rogue agency that, in effect, is ignoring state laws. Where specifically in state law, or do you think they're falling down on the job?
Well, I would just draw your attention back to that audit. There were a lot of failures mentioned in that audit, including a failure to research, you know, felons, people who should not have been voting. There were several instances of statutory responsibilities that were not followed. There was over 4 years, I believe, a failure of actually them being able to actually write the rules and regulations for their staff to be able to follow. Over and over again, that audit found a lot of shortcomings. Now, as I said, with these allegations, I think it's shifted into a higher gear, and that's why I'm calling for a new leadership.
If there is that new leadership, does that answer your questions, or are you looking for more fundamental changes in the way the Government Accountability Board operates, or even a replacement of that board with some other entity?
Well, I think that's two different questions, and up until this point in time, I think the Republicans, conservatives were looking at the opportunity for reform, and maybe that would have been under the same leadership. So I think that is a different question. Now or today we're talking about the leadership, and we've kind of already talked about that. But there are folks in the legislature, Dean Knudsen, for example, from the Hudson area, who has been researching what our opportunities might look like as far as being able to make reforms to the elections oversight process here in the state. So it's a little early to say what it might look like, but I think those discussions have been taking place.
Now, your press release also says, quote, harassment of conservative groups by Lois Lerner at the IRS at the federal level directly coincided with harassment of conservative groups right here in our state. Are you looking for, apart from this resignation, are you looking for any kind of investigation into that allegation?
I mean, I think we're going to have those conversations with the Attorney General's office. I mean, I think it is probably time for an investigation to take place as to whether or not this has been a coordinated effort. But to me, that's regardless, the public needs to have that faith and trust in the system.
We are talking to Representative John Nygren, co-chair of Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee, about the call from him and other Republicans for Kevin Kennedy to step down from his job running the Government Accountability Board. Now, we talked to WPR News, talked to Jay Heck from Common Cause earlier today about these calls for Kennedy's resignation. We'll give a listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
This is not a surprise. This has been part of the narrative that the right has used all along to discredit the John Doe investigation, to discredit the Government Accountability Board, to go after Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm and the whole John Doe process. And I think on the eve of Governor Walker's announcement for the presidency, this is just a further attempt to try to paint the investigation as some kind of witch hunt.
So, in effect, a claim that you and fellow Republicans are playing defense here for Governor Walker when it comes to John Doe. How do you respond to what you heard there?
Well, personally, I can't talk about, I guess, the conspiracy theory that this might be a coordinated effort. If Mr. Heck has proof of that, I'd like to see it. But this is legitimate concerns that we have. I can't affect the timing of it. These are legitimate concerns that I think every citizen of the state of Wisconsin should have that same level of skepticism about the leadership's ability to conduct elections in a fair and balanced way. You know, if there's a small percentage of people in Wisconsin, should we ignore that level of concern? I would actually suggest that rather than a small percentage of people that have concerns about their impartiality, it's a major percentage of the citizens of Wisconsin have that same concern. So because of that, I think we do need to seriously talk about this issue and look for new leadership.
Now, the Wall Street Journal's opinion piece and these calls for Kevin Kennedy's resignation center around the idea that he and Government Accountability had coordinated in some way with the IRS, intentionally targeting conservative groups. I mean, is it possible we could see this is a state election official who says, hey, it looks like these groups might be violating federal law as well? The controlling agency for this part of that aspect is the IRS, so he was just doing his job, in effect?
Well, let's not forget the things that we do know about the IRS, and that was things that were being done improperly at the IRS during that same period of time, improper targeting of conservative groups, and now we come potentially come to light these allegations that Kevin Kennedy was having direct communications with Lois Lerner at that very same time. Is it possible they were things that were appropriate? Yes, but I think this also casts a shadow of the doubt. Whether things were being done nefariously or not, and that's why we're having this discussion.
If Kevin Kennedy doesn't respond and resign in answer to your call, what would the next step be for you and your colleagues who are making this call today?
I think that the next step is a conversation with the Attorney General's office. I think the next step is continuing to look at reforms of the system that we use to run a fair and clean election here in our state.
All right, Representative Nygren, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. That was Representative John Nygren. He is co-chair of Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
Some young female celebrities and top fashion models have intentionally turned their hair gray.
And as someone who's been noticeably gray from an early age, it made me wonder what that might mean for how women are looking at aging and beauty. Ann Kramer is the author of Going Gray, How to Embrace Your Authentic Self with Grace and Style. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So do we know how long women have been coloring their gray hair?
In 1950, about 7% of American women dyed their hair, and then in the 60s, when Clairol introduced living color, it was easy for women in the privacy of their homes, with not much money and pretty much a safe product, to begin to dye their hair. And I think what happened is that we started going to work in significant numbers at the same time and kind of decided to throw out our, housewife imagery and reinvent ourselves, and hair dye kind of coincided with that exact same moment.
So before hair dye was even available, how would you say that gray hair was perceived? Was it just an expected part of aging?
Oh, absolutely, I think it was. I mean, I think prior to the 50s and, and Clairol introducing this color, the only people who dyed their hair were people in, media, in movies, the kind of Jean Harlow look. And it was tended to be associated with, I think, on some level, more loose morals in some capacity. And then that just kind of flipped on a dime. Today I think it's safe to say Clairol says that the percentage of people who dyes their hair is 75% pretty much in all areas of the country. It's not just a kind of coastal or urban-rural phenomenon. All women think it is an essential tool in their lives.
And do we know if that really cuts across different races and cultures as well?
Yes, it does cut across different races and cultures. And in fact, you know, I did not focus my book, obviously, on the larger global culture, but, you know, women in Japan and in India have been using sort of dyeing products for an extremely long period of time.
So before that 1950s period when hair dye was readily available and gray hair was just accepted before that as, you know, something that happens to your hair, once there was that option, was the perception of gray hair different after women were thought of as having a choice of whether to go gray or not?
Well, yes, although I think that it was encouraged and, in fact, even shaped by the marketing campaigns of the people in the beauty industry. You know, if you go back and you kind of YouTube, Google, and look at old ads, there's these wonderful ones of sort of, you know, women packing their bags to go on an exotic trip somewhere because they dyed their hair and their husband suddenly found them, you know, miraculously more attractive. And I think it became deeply ingrained with a kind of sense of sexual identity and sort of prowess. And at the same time, you know, we also became in the 60s sort of youth obsessed, you know, the youth culture, the youth quake, everything that went along with that. And so marketers targeted that holy grail of 18 to 24 year olds. And it was, there's the belief that if you dye your hair, you will look whatever that kind of golden age might be.
So some young women, including some celebrities, not just Lady Gaga, who's a different color every day, but she has been seen with gray hair, but even a top fashion model has been seen sporting gray hair. What do you think might be behind the fact that some young women are intentionally turning their hair gray now?
I would like to think it speaks to a larger sense of, you know, tolerance and acceptance of the aging process. But what I honestly think is that it is a kind of fashion statement. If everybody has the same sort of color of blonde hair with the same quality of highlights, a differentiating tool can be to have your hair a different color. You know, I've long said that I think gray is a beautiful color, and it's not just one sort of flat thing. There's pearl gray, there's, you know, salt and pepper gray, there's slate gray, there's all sorts of colors. And I think that, you know, on one level, young women dyeing their hair gray speaks to it just as being another color in the portfolio that people can use to express identity. I don't think it's going to be a long-term phenomenon, however.
Although, is it possible that, whether the intention is there or not, that seeing young women sporting fashionable gray hair and as part of kind of a hip trend, might that bleed over and make some women who are turning gray naturally maybe a little more open to owning their own color instead of covering it up?
I would hope so. I mean, I really would hope that that would be the case. I think that the trend towards plastic surgery might belie that a little bit. Nothing would make me happier than for women not to feel pressured to kind of conform to external standards of what is beautiful, particularly as our population ages as we are moving forward.
How different would you say the perception is of men with gray hair?
Night and day. Although, you know, hair care is the largest segment of the beauty industry, which is a huge industry in and of its own, and these are all publicly traded companies, so they have to find, you know, market growth in some area, and so men are now very much being targeted by the beauty industry to feel the need to dye their hair as well. If you look at a lot of newscasters on television, a lot of the men do, you know, from Chris Matthews on, do dye their hair. So I think that they're feeling pressure in the same way women probably did, you know, back in the 50s and 60s.
We're talking with Ann Kramer. She's the author of Going Gray, How to Embrace Your Authentic Self with Grace and Style. We are talking about young women choosing to go gray and what that may or may not mean for images of women and aging. If you'd like to join in, you can leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's Central Time on Facebook, or call 800-642-1111. 1234. Now, Anne, you went through a very public process of letting your hair grow gray as you approached 50. I am actually approaching 50 myself, but I have been gray longer than I can even remember. And it was very interesting for me reading your blogging, kind of day-to-day feelings about it, how much you found yourself feeling about it and thinking about it. What kinds of reactions did you get from friends, family, or even strangers as you made that transition to owning your gray hair?
A lot of people will come up to me and say, oh, you can do that because you have great gray hair, you know, or you can do that because you have blue eyes. And I think that's a sort of security mechanism, a safety mechanism that sort of allows women not to necessarily think that they can do it. I do believe, you know, women of all ethnicities and of all quality of hair and skin tone can be radiantly beautiful with their gray hair. But, in the book, I really wanted to dig deeper and sort of probe our notions about attractiveness and or professional viability. And one of the most interesting things I did, although I've been happily married to the same man now for, you know, approaching 40 years, is I went on Match.com with my hair the color I had previously dyed it, which was a dark brown, and then 6 months later went on with my hair the gray color that it had become, with every other piece of information exactly the same. And in New York, Chicago, and L.A., three times as many men were interested in going out with me with my hair gray as they were with my hair dyed, which flabbergasted me. I had done the experiment thinking I was going to get exactly the opposite results, and I found that deeply heartening, that we don't have to feel that in order to feel attractive in our skins that we need to conform to one narrow kind of sense of beauty.
I have to say, I saw side-by-side pictures of you on your blog with the dark hair and then with the gray hair. You had also cut several inches off when
yes,
you were graying too. And I have to say, hands down, you were rocking the gray hair. I mean, you looked like if Grace Kelly had gotten a chance to age, you looked like Grace Kelly. So.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you, Judith. That's very kind. But it actually just felt better. I mean, I think that there was a kind of lightness of spirit that came along with making that transition. I, you know, literally cut a fair amount off just to get rid of the cruddy old dyed ends. But it was also just a sense of kind of agency and a place in my life and gaining control over how I wanted to interact with the world.
Heidi in Milton is on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I called in because I'm 58 and a half, and I started getting gray when I was 21, and I did a few things about it, but then after a while I just said, this is crazy, and I just let it go, and it's nearly white, and I'm like everyone's mentor for letting their hair go white or gray, and everyone's like, oh, I wouldn't touch it, I wouldn't do a thing. So it's really interesting, and I find in the arts community, a lot of us don't color it either. So I don't know. It seems like it's a trend that's coming within the community, but I think it's interesting.
Thanks for that call, Heidi. And Anne, what would you say?
I do think it's probably easier for women who work in the arts community to go there. I would also suggest that we should all sort of try and change our language about letting go, which shows the degree to which dyeing our hair has such an iron lock on how we view women and their hair. We have to use the word let go of dyeing. But I also went back to corporate headhunters with my gray hair, trying to see what my reception might be in the corporate community. And they were very discouraging. I do think that there is profound ageism that comes in the professional world that prevents people ranging from Hillary Clinton to, you know, we have all these female senators. Not a single one of them has gray hair. Mm-hmm. And you'd think in a position in our country that would require kind of maturity and experience and kind of gravitas, they would feel comfortable doing that. And even they don't.
Well, so, and you see how much President Obama has grayed in his years in office.
Yes, absolutely. But so I don't think we have many role models in the corporate world, nor do we have them in the political realm. We certainly don't have them in the media. You know, Katie Couric had me on her show once, and she did a stunt where she put on a gray wig, and she looked fantastic. But never in a million years would she, I think, allow herself the permission to do that and feel like she could keep her position in the media.
So what did you learn about yourself in the process of, we won't say letting yourself go gray, but embracing your gray?
One of the interesting things was Betty Friedan wrote a book called The Fountain of Age, and in it she sort of explored all the different research and data that we have, you know, collected about aging. And what she found stunned me, and I believe this to be true, that the more people sort of acknowledge the biological age that they are, they actually end up living longer. And so I think that there's an ease that comes with looking in the mirror and, you know, every day my hair will change color moving forward and people are constantly stopping me saying, oh, who highlights it? What? Nobody, nature. And that allows you to be here now. It's a kind of meditative process almost. And I had failed to realize that my, you know, clinging so tenaciously to the schedule of getting my roots dyed was keeping me from being in the moment.
Well, Ann Kramer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Judith. It was a lot of fun.
Ann Kramer is the author of Going Gray, How to Embrace Your Authentic Self with Grace and Style.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. Millions of Americans live with a limited food budget because of a fixed income or on food benefits that come out to just a few dollars a day.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has advice and recipes to help people with a limited amount of money to spend on food and cooking to make not just food, but food that's fun to cook and enjoyable to eat.
Leanne Brown joins us now. She's the author of Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a day. Leanne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. I'm excited to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. This all started as your food science master's project. What led you to try to put this particular type of cookbook together?
Well, yeah, so it's actually not food science, it's food studies, which is this kind of new field that's only been around for about 12 years now. And it's kind of a melding together of food policy and study of the food system and culture, kind of trying to bridge the gap between nutrition and public health a little bit. So basically it came together because I was really interested in spreading my absolute love and joy of cooking. And I really also felt that, you know, people who are living on a really significant budget, in particular people who are living on SNAP or food stamps, are really sort of underrepresented in the food movement and didn't really have as much of a voice, I think, in the world of food as they should. And I just wanted it to be well known and well understood that the key to great food is cooking, not necessarily budget, and that there's still all kinds of really, really marvelous food to be had for very little.
Now, you initially, Leanne, made this available online as a free PDF. It's still available. We have a link to that on our Central Time Facebook page. But as I understand it, you just kind of put it out there not expecting much. But then, what happened?
Yeah, I didn't. I actually kind of put it out there after I had initially thought, oh, I'm going to share this with all of these nonprofits in New York City, and that people were interested in it, but I hadn't really gotten anything going, and I just kind of said, okay, I'll just put it online and whatever, we'll see. And then a few short weeks later, it ended up on a listserv on Reddit, and all kinds of people got so excited about it and were writing about it and writing to me and downloading the cookbook so fast it actually broke my website, which was hilarious at the time because there had been like maybe 17 people had visited it before that.
Well, you're not just trying to stretch out people's food budgets, although that's a worthy goal in and of itself, but you're really trying to make food that's fun and tasty. Why is that so important to this project?
Oh, man. Well, it's so important because I think that sometimes budget food kind of has this reputation, I think, as being sort of the boring stuff you have to eat. Like, I mean, I don't want to even say any one thing, but you sort of think about tuna casserole and sort of, you know, all lentils, these types of things. And those types are absolutely wonderful in moderation, but I think that they can seem sort of like what you expect. And I wanted people to understand that that all kinds of great food, modern food, is available on very small amounts of money, and to really spread the sort of delight that, that can be had through eating. I think, you know, we get to eat three times a day if we're lucky, and it's an every single, you know, one of those meals is an opportunity to have something really wonderful that can really fill you up and make you happier. And I want people to be as able to take advantage of that as they possibly can be.
Well, and one key to taking advantage of good food, whether you're on a limitless budget or a very limited budget, is knowing how to prepare things. And you also, you don't assume that people know some of the basic cooking techniques because not everyone was taught those. What are some of the basic techniques that you find really useful when you're trying to cook good food on a budget and probably on a time budget as well?
Oh, man. Well, there's so many. It's almost like, I guess I would say, so the biggest thing is to just sort of not overthink it. Like, try the simpler stuff first. When you're cooking from basic ingredients, you know, things in the most raw state, like a can of tomatoes and some dried pasta and a little bit of garlic, is always going to come together into a meal that is actually much more flavorful and more exciting than a jar of pre-made pasta sauce and the pasta again. And so it's really about sort of taking things a little bit more slowly and, you know, making sure you add salt, making sure you add like a little bit of lemon juice, making sure you add garlic, whatever flavors are really what you enjoy, are things that you should look to most of the time to sort of flavor up your more basic ingredients. And you'll find that when you're cooking from these nice things, like really like fresh garlic tastes good, fresh tomatoes taste wonderful, and when you're cooking in season and you can get these things, food just naturally tastes really, really good, and you don't actually have to try super, super hard.
We're talking to Leanne Brown about her new cookbook, Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a Day. We'll get to recipes in just a few moments, Leanne, but one of the keys, it seems like, to what you're putting together here is versatility, ingredients that you can use in different kinds of dishes, techniques that apply across dishes, and you mentioned seasonal, you know, recipes that can fit in whatever happens to be available at a good price right now.
Absolutely. So, yeah, salads that can incorporate whatever, you know, vegetables are in season or, you know, stews and things. All the recipes are extremely flexible, and I think that's so important because you need to maybe be able to, you know, one of the keys to budgeting is to buy something in bulk, buy a larger amount of it, and then use it across a few different things. And so I really encourage that people buy ingredients that they're comfortable with and that they can use in multiple ways. You know, things like eggs. Eggs are so versatile. They can be really fancy, beautiful quiche, or they can be scrambled eggs. They can be a fried egg. They can be on top of another dish to sort of add a little bit more protein. They can be a great way to use up any, you know, leftover produce that is wilting at the end of the week and scramble with some eggs, and suddenly you have something really enjoyable. Just really thinking through those workhorse ingredients and using them to the best of your ability.
Well, Leanne, I was lucky enough to be at a presentation you did and tried a recipe that fits a lot of what you just said. The vegetable quiche, hold the crust. We've got that, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page, a recipe and a picture. Leanne, can you tell us a little bit about that recipe?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So that one is such a good example of this. It's just so simple. I think of it as the sort of end of the week, throw whatever you happen to have left in the fridge in with these eggs, which is, I mean, a quiche, it sounds so fancy. You say, oh, it's French, it must be hard, all these kinds of things. And so this one is actually crustless, so you skip the sort of tougher part. Not the crust isn't wonderful, but it can take a little longer. This is really just vegetables or whatever you have around. Some, you know, of course, you could add like pieces of ham or something like that you like, floating basically in this beautiful egg custard with a little bit of cheese and milk or cream, and it just bakes up into this beautiful thing. You can add, you can slice off pieces, and it feels really special to eat. But really, made up of very inexpensive basic ingredients, you'll find just about anywhere.
So, Leanne, one of the things I think people assume about eating cheaply is that there's not going to be any room for meat in a budget. But
right.
You do a really good job of including meat in some recipes, maybe not in the quantity that people are used to eating, but also kind of bridging the divide that's often there between meat dishes and vegetarian dishes. And for instance, you talk about making lentil and beef burgers that are kind of the best of both worlds.
Right, yeah. Meat is absolutely something that I know is, you know, personally, I don't eat very much meat. And some people are vegetarian. To people who need to eat it every day to feel full. And I wanted everyone to be able to, if meat is extremely important to you, you should not cut it from your diet. And but I wanted to sort of show how it doesn't need to be the center of the plate. In fact, that can kind of make food a little bit dull. And it's certainly not a very balanced or healthy way to eat when you're eating large, large quantities of meat at every meal. So I wanted to show how it can be, in general, a bit more of a flavor component than the sort of main star of the dish. And that's something that is not in any way new to most other world cuisines. Like outside of America, meat tends to be used as just a part of the flavor of a dish rather than the whole enchilada, so to speak.
We are talking to Leanne Brown about cooking on a budget. She's the author of Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a Day.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have some advice or ideas on cooking good food on a budget? Or do you have a question for Leanne about cooking good and cheap food? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And while you're there, check out her recipes for that vegetable quiche, hold the crust, and peanut butter and jelly granola bars. We'll talk about that in a few moments. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We continue our conversation now with Leanne Brown, author of Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a Day. She's sharing advice and recipes for people cooking on a tight budget who still want delicious food.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite recipe that doesn't cost too much? Do you have some advice to share with us about keeping costs down in the kitchen? Or do you have a question for Leanne about her recipes, her project, her philosophy on cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page and check out a couple recipes while you're there.
And one of those recipes is peanut butter and jelly granola bars. Leanne, why is that a good budget recipe?
Oh, man, I am so proud of that one. So that one came out of basically at a lot of, in general, obviously, I would love for no one to ever have to go to a food bank or a food pantry. But the reality is that that still may be the way that some folks some people have to do to make their budget work. And at just about every food pantry, you're going to find oats and peanut butter and some kind of jam or jelly. And so most people, of course, are going to be making a lot of sandwiches. They're going to be having oatmeal. And I just really wanted to find a different use for those ingredients. And I thought, you know, most granola bars are these really complex recipes. They're not complex, but they have a really long list of ingredients. You know, these seven kinds of nuts and all these syrups and all these special things. And so I thought, if I could just make a granola bar that's really made out of oats and peanut butter and jelly, that would be this wonderful, useful thing. And so that's really what it is. It's just, you sort of warm up the peanut butter and jelly, and the jelly sort of helps it bind together. You warm it up on the stove. And then you mix that in with the oats, just uncooked oats. So that I like to add a little bit of rice cereal for some crunch if you happen to have that around. If you don't, it's no problem. And then you mix it all together. You bake it like bars, like, you know, brownies or lemon bars or whatever. And then you spread the rest of the jam on top and you let it bake. And then you just slice them up into little bars and you have a wonderful on-the-go breakfast that's a little bit different and made out of really basic stuff that most everyone is going to have around.
We have those peanut butter and jelly granola bars on the Central Time Facebook page, and some of Leanne's suggested variations on that are there as well. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Christine on the line in Harvard, Illinois. Christine, hi.
Hi, how are you? I love the show today, and one of the things that I found help our family is, you know, get to know your local butcher or, as far as the grocery store. And, you know, when meat is getting marked down, you can, you know, purchase some of those, you know, higher cuts, you know, expense-wise of meat and be able to freeze it or cook it that day. You know, within a matter of days, you know, the meat could be being marked down. You could throw it in your freezer when you're, you know, getting ready to use it. Sometimes it's marked down even half, you know, the price of what it would have been, you know, on the first couple of days of, you know, being out on the rack there.
Christine, thanks a lot for that call. And Leanne, we were talking about versatility earlier with some of the stews and other things in your recipe. If chicken's on sale that day, if beef's on sale that day, do a lot of these work with different kinds of meat?
Oh, absolutely. And Christine is so right about that. I mean, the idea of having a relationship with your butcher is so, so great if you can possibly do that. I think, you know, yes, of course, absolutely. A lot of the recipes in the book work for different types of meat, different types of cuts of meat. Your butcher is also someone you can ask about things. You can say, hey, this meat is on sale, but, like, I don't know how to cook it. What should I do? And they'll usually give you great advice. Another thing they're amazing for is you can get bones often for free from your butcher if you ask for them. And if you have a bunch of bones, you can make incredible stock, which, you know, for pennies or practically nothing. You know, just boiling these bones, and you can have this incredible stock that you can use in all kinds of other things.
Christine also mentioned the fact that that's one way to feed a larger crowd, and certainly regardless of what kind of a food budget you're on, there are going to be special occasions where you want to get a bunch of friends or family together. Can you give us some advice on cooking for a lot of people, maybe for one of those gatherings?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, and honestly, cooking for larger amounts actually is easier than cooking for one. That's one of the sort of challenges when I was writing the book, was thinking about, you know, people who are on their own, it's a little bit harder to stretch that budget. When you have a larger crowd to feed, you can get larger amounts of different things and then make multiple things. So something, actually, this past weekend, I was encouraging everyone to make pulled pork for the 4th of July because it's such a wonderful, inexpensive cut of meat, the pork shoulder. And you basically just cover it in a beautiful spice rub. You can make one in the book or do one that's a little bit more simple, and basically just cook it in the oven overnight. Or you can do it in a crock pot or grill if you're knowledgeable there. And you wake up in the morning with a beautiful smell, and all you have to do is pull it apart, and you can use it in tons of different things. And, you know, obviously it's a very large amount of meat, so you could probably give a fair number of people like a big portion, but you could also, you know, ration it a little bit by having it with salad and, you know, thrown into a taco with some extra vegetables and these kinds of things, having it in sandwiches. So having it with a bunch of other things, you're getting a lot of that flavor without just sort of eating that giant pile of pork.
Talking to Leanne Brown about cooking on a budget. Her book is Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a Day, as we continue Food Friday. We'll go to a caller now, Sarah in southwestern Wisconsin. Sarah, hi.
Hi, good to talk to you. I really appreciate this. I'm actually on the way lower end of the socioeconomic scale, at least. I have been on food stamps and am on food stamps, and I know other people who are. I appreciate very much the wonderful advice and the opportunity to eat better. I've been an advocate for that for several of my friends and family members. There's a few problems. Somebody, you know, actually while we were talking, I was chopping up some greens and putting them in salt water to soak so I could have salad for the next couple of days. But one of the problems that comes in is lack of other resources. The recipes might be basically simple, but if you don't have adequate kitchen space to work, if you are working multiple jobs, if you don't have decent cookware, being struggling financially in and of itself is a mental tax. And I know people, when I talk to them about just making a small change, they freeze because they're already so overwhelmed that even something that might simplify their life, it just becomes very, very difficult for them to absorb new information when they're putting out fires everywhere else. Plus, a lot of people are poor for a reason. They might have medical issues or have a family member with medical issues, and that can cause other difficulties with the ability to prepare food. For me, with some of my medical issues, I have to plan not only how to get the food, how to store the food, use it in a timely fashion, and how to clean up afterwards.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call, and I want to give Leanne a chance to talk about that. And I'm sure, Leanne, Sarah's not alone. Sarah and her friends are not alone in dealing with these other issues outside of the food itself.
No, not at all. They're super important issues, and I would never want to suggest that sort of just cooking can solve all of these problems. By no means is that the case. There's so many more issues at play here. I think one sort of hopeful thought is that, you know, you don't have to change your entire life. You don't have to start cooking all the time, every single meal. If there is just one or two things that you can do on occasion, I think that can make a big difference, because cooking and just eating good food can bring a lot of joy and I think a lot of energy to life. Or certainly, that's been my personal experience and the experience of a lot of people that I've spoken with. And so if that can sort of help out in those difficult times, I really hope that food can be something that can be healing through its enjoyment. But it's absolutely true. I think the other issue about kitchen equipment is really well taken and something that comes up a lot. You have to have a place to cook in order to be able to prepare good food.
It seems like some of the ingredients that are best to have around, things like spices and good quality olive oil, which is healthy and delicious, those are initial outlays that are pretty significant. Do you have advice on how to kind of spread out the cost of those?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing crazy. Really, it's just, and it may not be possible for everyone. As I said, I really think that being, you know, single or in smaller households, those things can be difficult. When you have a larger family and you have just sort of a little bit more money sort of total, even if it's, you know, very little across all of the people, it can allow you to make those sorts of purchases. But really, it's sort of thinking week by week or even month by month. And sort of if you can slowly build up those things, if you can find a way to budget so that you can buy one of those things that will last you into the next month and the next month.
Leanne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That was Leanne Brown, author of Good and Cheap, Eat Well on $4 a Day. We have two of her recipes up at the Central Time Facebook page and a link to her website where you can get a PDF of the book.
All the time we see previews of upcoming TV shows, computer games, and especially movies, where you have to make it through 6 or 7 trailers before you get to the movie you actually came to see. Sometimes with a big anticipated movie, people get excited just to see that trailer.
Well, there's a sneak preview that has people talking today, but it's not for a movie or even a TV show. It's a book. The book world has been buzzing about the release of a sequel to the classic To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. The new book is called Go Set a Watchman. Today, the publisher boosted the excitement level for the sequel by releasing the first chapter of the book to the Wall Street Journal and The Guardian in print and read by Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, it's not often. I mean, there are book trailers I've watched online, and there are preview chapters sometimes. It's rare that there's this much excitement about an upcoming book, that people are excited about just the sneak preview, this taste of it.
Right. It's kind of crazy. And I have to say, I really enjoy if there's an author I like Alexander McCall Smith, for example. Sometimes there's a first chapter of the next book that's coming out at the end of the current one. But this is really unheard of.
Well, the one thing that gets me sometimes is George R. R. Martin in the Game of Thrones. You're waiting 12 years for the next book to come out. He'll occasionally put out a chapter from the next book that kind of tides over that urge. So that maybe there's a future for these book previews.
Or fan fiction.
I think a lot of them discourage that, actually. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.